You're listening to the Mindbrew Chats podcast, bringing you stories and honest conversations about mental health, well-being, and life. From Kuching, Sarawak. Grab your favorite brew and join us now.
Hello, folks, and welcome again to another edition of Mindbrew Chats. Today, we're going to have a conversation with educators. And hosting along with me is my good friend, Laura.
Hello, everyone.
And filling in for Hazel is another good friend of mine, Celine.
Hi. I am feeling good. Very excited.
For the educators, we have with us Jingyi and Gladys. So guys, how are you two doing?
Hello.
Hey. We're very sleepy for being teachers nowadays. I think I caught you on a really long day, have I?
It's a Friday night.
Weekends.
It's a weekend. Ah, one of those days. So, for all you out there, Jingyi and Gladys are educators. Just a little bit of background. Jingyi teaches at a high need school, so it's very much a public school, whereas Gladys teaches in a kind of like a private school. We're going to be talking to two educators from two different schools or two different formats of schools, but we'll be focusing on how they are doing during this period. And the current period is, well, we all know that COVID is in Malaysia, and it's kind of like very stressful, especially for people with mental health issues, but we also want to hear from our educators. So, Jingyi, how has it been for you during this period?
I just found out half an hour ago that schools where I'm teaching are being closed down again for 2 weeks. Ooh. Yeah, so that's news to me. So we'll be going back to online learning, which was very stressful during MCO. There have been a lot of changes that we've had to do with, just trying to stay flexible, trying to stay positive. Yeah.
Wow. And I think, Jingyi, I think Gladys is in the same boat too. Right, Gladys? I mean, what about you? How have you been doing?
Pretty much in the same boat. At least we started going online again today and for the next 2 weeks too. And I don't know, I think like this whole year has just been like, I don't know, some tornado or something. I think like everyone says, oh, it's adapting to the new normal. But like, I think the new normal is like just this like big word that consists of so many things, you know, like you have to learn new things, you got to plan, then you have to throw away what you plan and adjust and make new plans. And then half of it probably doesn't work. And so, like, you know, everyone says, like, oh, you know, hope, like, we can't wait for 2020 to end and, like, have 2021. But then now I'm, like, thinking, I don't know if 2021 is going to be actually better.
But do you have, like, a stronger reaction to the second school closure? Or was it like, again?
I think for me, it's more that it's almost the end of the school year and there are things that we wanted to finish up. You know, by the time school ends in December, but suddenly school's closing down for 2 weeks and you're not even sure if they will reopen after 2 weeks. That means like most of your plans might not, you know, happen. And thinking about that means I will be ending my contract by this year. So there are a lot of things that I wanted to do and achieve that will just have to, I have to scrap all those plans. Yeah. And there's also the fact that you can see how students were affected by the first MCO, and now you think about them going back into that time where they're just stuck at home and they're not learning. That worries me a lot, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think they're like just worried. I think the thought of going online itself, again, it's not scary because we've done it before, but I think it's more like, again, and you know, it means that it's a sign of not so good things gonna happen. and it's really not what we pictured. Ideally, the end of at least 2020. I hope to like salvage a bit of 2020. You know what's left, and like at least like close out still relatively okay. But I don't know what that looks like now.
Yeah, it feels like we were just starting our engines because schools just reopened like 2 months ago, and then we're like, okay, we can get something done now, and then they shut down again. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for educators, and it's kind of like start and then restart and start and restart again. It's like, why don't we just start all over again in January, like totally, you know, instead of all these 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks. But then at the end of the day, like, we're not sure when this situation is going to pan out. I mean, and that uncertainty is a huge measure of stress. Wouldn't you say so? I mean, especially for educators, it's stressful right now, right? Celine, what about you guys? You're a uni student, an active university student. How are you guys coping at this time?
So, like, since the COVID situation is not very good in Kuching right now, my uni has suspended all in-person classes or labs. Like, we've still been doing online classes, but like some students are going back to class to do labs or like other stuff that requires the facilities. But now we're all like, it's all cancelled and it's in the middle of the semester, so everything has to change, like the assessments and everything has to change. So it definitely has been, it's very uncertain. Like, it's not very, it doesn't add to my stress way too much, I feel, because it didn't change a lot, but it's definitely very uncertain on how like this semester will go, I think. And like, we're also not sure if we are able to go back to in-person classes next year.
I'm just wondering, 2020 being the train wreck that it has been, will we all reach a point where I just feel numb and be like, whatever, you know, it is what it is. We will just deal with whatever comes the best that we can. But to stress about it, to worry about it, we are way past that. It's like you are desensitized to more bad news.
I feel like I'm kind of at that point already. I would say, yeah. I think despite saying that I'm numb to all the bad news, whenever something new pops up, you do still kind of have an initial reaction to it. And after that, you're like, oh, okay. It's kind of a long, long laundry list of things that went wrong this year. And so you kind of deal with it however you can. That's one thing that I learned this year as well. It's kind of that it's an uphill battle kind of to just fear and like anticipate all the things that can go wrong, or even when things go wrong and you kind of latch onto it and like feel, spend too much time thinking about how it's gone wrong. Like, being able to accept it means I get to move on quicker. Yeah, and considering how things have been this year, if I don't move on, I feel like you can just crumble under the weight of all of it. Yeah.
I think that's true. I think especially as educators, like, we really kind of have to be the first ones to accept things as it is. I mean, we don't downplay the effects and the consequences, but we learn to look past them so that we can actually turn to those who are actually looking to us. Because, you know, students still come to classes, like, yeah, they go to online classes, they don't expect much. But if we ourselves are not expecting much, then we really cannot. It's really hard for them to expect anything else, like, more. So, I think it's, like, sometimes the burden is also, like, learning how to look past that and learning how to pitch things to, like, the students in a most attractive way possible so that they still want to learn despite everything that's going on.
So what I'm hearing is that educators have to be much, much stronger than anyone else, really, because you are the ones who have to put on a brave face to give your students hope. Because if you are the ones who's crumbling and saying that, you know, this can't be done, I don't know what to do, I just can't, that is going to reflect onto your students. So do you feel that this is a heavy burden that you bear? having to be that person for your students who are looking to you?
The short answer is yes.
That's very, actually, you're right. You know, when you said that, I realized that I've never gone to class and say, guys, I don't know what to do today. Like, you just can't say that, you know? And you'll be like, you'll be thinking, guys, in your head, you're like, oh, I wonder what we're going to do today. Like, how can I make class more interesting in front of a PC where I can't actually see them, their cams are not open. And you're like, you know, guys, you know, you want to turn on your cameras, you know, we can interact more. And you, I guess it's a further as well, but I think in a sense, like, it does present a challenge. Like, I think educators, we also want to always innovate. Like, you don't always want to, like, stick to the same old things. And because it does, I think it can't always fit the situation. So I think it's partly a burden, but I think it's also a good challenge, right? Like, I think it really challenges me to try and think outside the box as much as I can and try to innovate for, like, the kids so they actually still have a good learning experience.
What about you, Jingyi?
It is a very heavy burden. I think, as what Gladys was saying, it reminded me of something that a lecturer of mine back in, like, teacher training would say, is that teachers are essentially performers, and that's your job. You have to go into classrooms and pretend you know what you're doing, even if you don't know what you're doing. You have to pretend, you know, that you can handle all this, even if you can't. So, like, sometimes you might not know exactly what you're going to do, but you're going to go in and show your students that, yeah, we are going to learn something today. We are going to do it, despite the challenges that we might face. Yeah,
I have such respect for educators and the great work that you do. Without teachers, our entire system would collapse. I come from a family of teachers. My grandfather, my sister, my mom, they are all teachers, and I have nothing but respect for the great work that you do.
I mean, I like that point from Jingyi where these teachers are performers and the audience is your students. So just to give us a little bit of background on what your audience is like, maybe we can go with Jingyi to, like, tell us a little bit about the school that you teach at. I know on the surface level that the school is a public school, and maybe you want to talk more about it and just tell us more about the school that you're teaching at. Jingyi?
Okay, so I teach in a school in Johor. It's about 20 minutes away from Johor Bahru. The location of the school is basically, it's an industrial area, and the families that my students come from are quite complicated. They would either have parents who are not around, like, some of them are working in Singapore, some of them are staying with relatives, uncles, aunts, grandparents, so they might not see their parents for months on end. So since MCO and since the borders have been closed down, they have not seen their parents for 7 months, 8 months. Yeah, and other than that, like, some of their parents might be working in the area, so working in the factories in the area. This is also the same area where we had the toxic waste pollution from last year, Kim. So I would consider this a community where people are not very invested in these kids. That tends to show in their behavior, yeah, and their development.
Do you have counselors in the school, Jingyi?
Yeah, so I have two counselors in my school. The ministry's the ratio that for students to counselor is supposed to be 500 to 1. So I have about 800 students in my school.
What are some of the I'm just looking at it from a mental health perspective. What are some of the issues that you see among your students?
I would probably categorize it with, like, two types. So there's a type of student who may exhibit, like, very disruptive behavior, who generally, like, they don't really have awareness in, like, social awareness or, like, emotional awareness. So they don't really get along well with people. They don't really know what they're doing, kind of go along with life, however it is. And, like, when crisis happens in their lives, like when the Kim river pollution thing happened or when MCO hit, there's not much of a reaction in them. Kind of repressed feelings. And they don't really know how to talk about the issues that they face in life. And then there are some students who may have higher awareness, and that means that they are also having very high stress and high anxiety responses to the things that are happening to them.
And I'm just wondering, I forgot to ask you this early on. What subjects do you teach?
Okay, I currently teach English and math. When I first started in the school, I taught English, Chinese and maths because my school is we lack teachers. So you end up having to take on a lot of subjects and a lot of teaching periods. Yeah.
Gladys, what about you, the school that you would teach at?
So I teach at a private school in Kuching. It's a private international school. Though saying that, there are some international kids, but mostly are still, I think, like Chinese by race. And our biggest international population would probably be Koreans, I think. Since it is a private international school, on average, yes, the socioeconomic status, I think, of some of these kids on average, not everyone on average, is a bit higher. There are about 700 plus students, ranging from primary one all the way to adults. So that makes the ratio off for my school because I'm the only counselor there, not according to the 1-500 ratio. And I also teach psychology to the A-level students.
What kind of behavior have you noticed among your students during this period, Gladys?
Particularly during MCO, you mean?
Yeah, during MCO. Has it been stressful? Has it been... like, are they happy? They have, like, they don't have to come to school. What are they like?
I think during the first few weeks, they were happy that they didn't have to go to school. And then that kind of wore off. It's interesting. You see that wearing off. And even those who don't like to go to school, they're like, yeah, I kind of want to go to school. You know, like, I think they're so sick of being, like, confined to, like, one space for, like, 24-7, you know? And I mean, adults feel that way. What more, like, kids, right? And then I think some of them miss their friends as well because they can't really hang out, and there's so much you can do just by texting only. That's it. I think some of the main issues that they face is probably anxiety and depression. And I think these issues were already there even before MCO. Just that I think MCO probably made it worse or made things come out a bit more. Like, they are worried about a number of different things. And with MCO, all these worries are multiplied or increased. You know, now some are actually worrying about their studies. Can I finish my exams? Can I still go to UK? Should I just study local? Is it even safe to study locally? And then I think when they are stuck at home, sometimes if they are wrestling through certain family problems, I think that also gets heightened. And then they feel maybe some of them might struggle with loneliness or self-esteem, things like that. I think MCO tends to, I think it brings out the best and the worst of everyone.
I think the MCO kind of like compounds the anxiety and the stress in that manner.
Yeah.
What about you, Jingyi? I mean, are the kids like happy? Like, oh, I got a holiday from school and all that.
Yeah.
They're happy.
The majority of them were very happy. I think at one point they got quite bored. There are a group of students, there would be some of the students who had the same concerns that Gladys' students did. So whether or not they would get to finish the school year, whether or not they were falling behind, but the rest of my students were quite happy because they kind of just lived day by day, and like not needing to go to school seems like a good thing. But there's also like a group of students who might have trouble at home. So they come from very big families and like lower SES. So they could have six siblings. They're just all stuck at home together at the same time. That also makes learning impossible. Even if they had good internet connection, they had the devices to go online to learn, they just don't have the environment.
I just find that when everybody had to go online, there was minimal effort in trying to teach people how to do it effectively. For K-12 and high school, you still need a more pedagogy approach, a more rigid approach as opposed to what uni students basically are going into andragogy. It's self-directed learning. So when they go online, they're very much prepared for it because they have to practically do everything on their own without depending on the lecturers. What about you, Celine? I mean, do you find that going online for uni students is slightly easier because, heck, you guys don't even have to see your lecturers half the time in normal circumstances?
I feel called out. I do feel like it's harder because now you have to be more disciplined. You have to make sure that you go to lectures. I mean, like, watch your lectures and do your work, and everyone is so far away and your lectures are not as accessible. You can't like drop by the office. Your group mates may be in other states or other countries and you're just like, I can't see you in real life, and it feels almost harder than in-person learning. I feel like I actually don't really like online learning, but like it definitely has its benefits, being that I don't have to wake up early and I can do things on my own pace. But I would rather go to class than, like, because I don't have a schedule anymore, and I'm a huge procrastinator, so I'll stay up really late and rush all my assignments in one go, which is very, very bad. Yeah, so I would actually really prefer in-person learning more than online learning.
I find that in normal circumstances, and even more so during the situation we are in now today, educators have to play that role of motivator and encourager, because you really need to motivate your charge to study. And right up from Jingyi and Gladys' age group, and even Celine's age group, they need that motivator to get them onto class. So, throwing this out to both Jingyi and Gladys, right? Do you feel like this takes out a lot from the two of you? I mean, you have to motivate your students, but at the same time, you have to motivate yourself when you approach this. What do you think, Jingyi?
Thinking back to MCO, I myself was struggling with my own mental health, right? But you do have a job to do. You have a duty to your students. You care about your students. You want them to be able to learn. That took up a significant chunk of like my effort, just trying to motivate students. But the thing is, it was difficult even to reach my students sometimes. So I would say I would be able to reach maybe 50% of them. Another 50% is just completely off the grid, right? So even in the 50% that are left, there's maybe half of them who are relatively motivated, like they would kind of show up and do the work. For the rest, it's really just me trying to talk to them and be like, oh, you should still do this because, you know, schools are going to reopen, and when we reopen, you know, what's going to happen? You should try to learn. There was this one instance where I talked to one of my students because I was like, oh, well, you haven't been doing your work for like the past 4 weeks. So what's going on? Is there anything happening? It's like, no. Then what have you been doing at home? And he said like, oh, just basically sleeping and playing games. And I asked him like, why didn't you do your work? He's like, I don't know how to do. So I said, okay, yeah, now you can ask me because I'm here now. And he's like, I don't want to.
Oh, just like that, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah, and that happens like that. More. Like it happened with like a few kids, not directly in that way, but they would just be like, what are you going to do? Because like even when we were in person, in schools, in classes, they didn't like doing their work. They didn't like participating. So it got even worse when it was just like online. Like, what are you going to do to me? Nothing. Yeah.
And that being said, I'm amazed that you still go to class, whether virtual or in person, and still make an effort. I'm sure a lot of other people would have just rolled over and given up. Like, you don't want to learn, fine. Do whatever.
For the online classes, it was more like I understood that there were things that were out of my control. I would still prepare the work and like be available to students who wanted to learn. And then for the students who were MIA, like I knew there wasn't much that I could do for them because I couldn't find them, couldn't see them, you know, couldn't reach them. But in classrooms, they are there, you are there. Even though there are many things that are not in your control, like what happened to them the day before, whether or not they slept the night before. And that all affects their learning. But when I'm in my classroom, I basically just do my best to make sure that they participate.
What about you, Gladys? You're a school counselor, so were you actually better prepared to motivate and encourage your students to just learn during this period?
I feel like I have slightly different answers depending on what my role was, like as a teacher, because I think I taught older kids, so I think it was more like I felt like communicate with them a bit better because they are like, what, 16, 17, 18. And so on some degrees, some part was just really up to them if they wanted to do work. And then some part is like, if they would come and talk to me, or I'll come and ask them, hey, you know, are you doing okay? And usually they were kind of okay, although some just slacked off, and like it's a bit of what Jingyi said, although they wouldn't blatantly say it, like, I just don't want to. I don't think that they just say it to, you know, to like our faces. But yeah, so some struggle, and I think as a teacher, it was the tougher part was trying to find activities or like teach online in ways that they found interesting and they could still engage. I think that was really tough because it took so much brain juice and time trying to find those resources, and they are not always available, and you're in a crunch time. So I think that was part of difficulty. And then some part is you just like, and then when you don't have those creative ideas, you just have to stick to what you have. And you know, they are not the most interesting things. And then you're like trying to like, you know, guys, you know, let's just try to make the best out of things. So I think that's like the teacher side. On the counselor side, I think it was when I dealt with like some of the younger students. And yeah, students like you say that, oh, you know, I couldn't go to class because my connection is not very good. And I always get locked out. And like, oh, I didn't see the email from teacher asking for this. And like, I have to go to Google Classroom. Oh, or I forgot my password. Yeah. You know, like suddenly everything seems to fall apart. And sometimes you can't quite know whether it's an internet problem or it's a student problem. You know? And some wouldn't even be available for you to contact. Like, I remember dropping like this student, like, because he was on my radar, and we had a couple of sessions together even before MCO. So I was trying to follow up during MCO. It was so hard to reach because they don't respond to emails. So I went on Discord, because kids nowadays are on Discord, right? So I went on Discord and chatted with this boy, and like once in a while in a blue moon only he'll reply me. And most of the time if he replies me, it's not in a reply to my message, but it's asking, Miss, do you know when we can go back to school? I'm like, I don't know, you know? So I think it's tough to motivate them, and like do counseling like online, I think was like something we're totally not prepared for too. So,
yeah. It's interesting to hear from both Gladys and Jingyi, like students nowadays just ghosted their teachers, like, I don't want to talk to you.
Ghost is a good word.
Yeah, right. They kind of like ghosted you guys online, and kind of that's kind of like what they do.
I once talked to my friends, my teacher friends, and I told them like the relationship between like a student and a teacher, like the way that I love my students is like the greatest unrequited love of all. That's how I feel.
We sound so sad now as educators.
I think that's the thing about educators is that a lot of people don't realize how when they come into this, they're also human beings, and they come in with their emotions, they come in with their mental strength and all that, you know, and it takes a lot out of them to, as human beings, just to create relationship and to maintain relationship with the students. It's not just shoving down academic facts and figures, it's actually building trust and building a channel for the students to express themselves. And we are going to cover all of that in the second part of our special Mind Boost chat with educators. We're going to take a short break and we'll see you in a short while.
You are listening to the Mind Boost Chats podcast, bringing you stories and honest conversations about mental health, well-being, and life. From Kuching, Sarawak. Grab your favorite brew and join us now.
And welcome back again, folks. This is Mind Brew Chat with Educators. It's a special edition that we have ongoing for the Mental Health Awareness Month.
And jumping straight into part two of our little conversation with Gladys and Jingyi and Celine. Ladies, let me just ask you this. Working with students, how do you create safe spaces for your students to just express themselves? Jingyi, you want to go first?
I think it's related to what you said earlier about how teachers have to build relationships with their students. So definitely you have to go in and earn their trust so that they feel safe to share things that happen in their life with you and how they feel. But specifically for my students, there's also, I also try to incorporate social emotional learning into the lessons, because like I mentioned earlier, they might struggle with identifying what they're feeling or even to name the feelings that they might have. I started with just teaching them, you know, the names of feelings and what that might show up as in your body, whatever reactions you might have, and just try to normalize, you know, talking about feelings. I tend to ask them a lot, how do they feel when something happens, or you might talk about a certain topic, what does this make you feel? Share it with your friend, share it with me. Even during MCO, there was something that we did. Another fellow thought of this. Basically, we had these, whenever we send out work in Google Forms, right, they would have to answer like assignments. In the beginning of it, like they would have to put their name, their class, and then there's a part where we send like one of those memes, right? So it's like, which meme are you today? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? Which meme are you today? So it's easier for them to like identify, oh, maybe I don't have a name for the feeling, but okay, this is how I'm feeling today and why. So really getting to simplify things for them so that I could still access their inner world to just know how they're doing, then to kind of encourage them to explore it a little bit more. Other than that, for some of my students who are already more proficient in sharing their feelings or expressing themselves, I tend to give journal prompts. Some of the questions I've asked, it can be as simple as, like, when I don't have a specific question, it can be as simple as, what do you want me to know about you? What do you want to share with me that happened this week or that you're feeling? And it's been quite successful. Like, it's easier than coming up to a teacher and saying, oh, this is how I'm feeling and this is what happened to me today.
I mean, you kind of have to work at the basic things first, like naming that emotion, naming that feelings and just articulating it.
I'm just curious, like, is there any particular entry, journal entry that your students wrote that is stuck in your head?
There have been many, okay, but the first one that I thought of when you said that was, there was a girl who wrote about how she feels, so she's struggling with like body image. So she says that she feels sad because she gets made fun of because she's fat. And she says, she wrote something like, I don't know why I am the way I am. So she was struggling with those feelings. So when they write things like that to me, I tend to write responses back in their books.
I guess in this case, they tend to feel a little bit safe just writing it down than speaking it out. What about you, Gladys? I mean, what have you done in your school?
Actually, I think it's very similar to what Jingyi shared. I think because I teach psychology in class, we do talk about like human things. And so sometimes I let them watch a movie and I ask them to write reaction papers or reflection papers. And it can be as simple as, how did you feel about after watching this film and why? You know, something very simple. And sometimes you get very generic responses like, you know, they're probably just, you know that these are students just trying to finish their job and their assignment, hand it in. But some actually, like, you know, they really start telling you about themselves. And those are like the best things to read, because I know you just get to know students so much more. And I don't remember which one it was and what was the question, but I remember there was one student this year who wrote that he, I don't know what was the prompt, but he shared that he doesn't trust people. He really doesn't trust people because he learned that people will stab you in the back, and like people, like, you know, they say one thing but they do another thing. I was like, I don't know, it just like struck me at that moment, because I couldn't see that about this student at the first glance, because he's a very cheerful student, you know, very sociable. But when he wrote that, I was like, interesting, you know. So it made me start to like I feel like I started to see a different side that I thought I wouldn't have seen as much in class. And then it helped me, I felt, as a teacher to start to care better for the student. Like I was mindful, and then when we tried to do group work, like I'll like check on him and see like if he was doing okay. Are his team members like responding? Is he responding well to his teammates as well? Like little things like that, you know. So I think reaction papers were a really, really good thing. Like, and we even did like a small like quick reflection on a game, because I made them play a game like of a prisoner's dilemma. Not sure if you guys heard of it, but it's basically like you either you choose to cooperate with your teammate and you get more money, or you choose to be selfish and you hog more money for yourself at the expense of the other person. And the ideal is, you know, so basically it's a game of trust and cooperation, but after, and it involves real money. I put like real stakes, real money. So it, and like by random, I'll choose someone who win and they'll actually get 10% of their earnings. So that actually there was some like, I wanted to create that like urgency to like actually play properly. After that, you made them write a reflection paper, and it was like very interesting as well. And they're like, you know, just play safe, or like I thought it'd be nice to cooperate, but then I realized that there are always some selfish people in this world. You know, stuff like that. Like, it's very interesting. I mean, it's said so simply, but I feel it gives much insight into like people. Yeah, so those are little, I'm diverging, but some ways the students have shared. So there's the teacher side. On the counseling side, we've done expression boards before. Like, what are you thankful for today? How are you feeling? And again, we get mixed responses. Some are pretty honest, some I just put there for fun. So mixed responses, but hopefully all at least it gives some people space to share if they want to.
It's amazing how the two of you actually create these activities, because it's so easy to pick up on issues by just looking at the responses that your students put up, right? Through these activities, like I like the part about the journaling. Celine, just throwing this at you, wouldn't it have been fun for you back in high school if you had all of these activities? What do you think?
Journaling wise, I feel like, because like, okay, in my high school, like the conversation of mental health was like almost obsolete. We did not talk about any sort of mental health at all. I would imagine if we suddenly had like journaling activities, which we did not have, I feel like it would, like, because we were more reserved, I feel like me and my peers, in terms of our feelings, because we don't talk about it a lot and it's not a thing between us and our teachers, between us and our peers. Like, you're either, if you're sad, you are weird. If you are happy, you are, I don't know, happy, I guess. I feel like if I were to go back to my high school time and like suddenly I had a new teacher who was like, hey, tell me about your feelings, I'll be like, no, why?
Yeah, but I don't think that the culture was permissive enough for me to show vulnerability. I would have not been able to trust my teachers with that information. I'll be thinking, what are they going to do with that information? Are they going to send me somewhere to see someone? Or are they going to talk about it amongst themselves or in class? Are we forever with that kid?
I also feel like when you have these issues and you get sent to the counselor, and like getting sent to the counselor always always felt like Gladys is waving. Like when you get sent to the counselor, it always looks like you did something wrong. Like to your peers, it's like, hey, why do you get sent to the counselor? Like, is there something wrong with you? Like, so it's like, it's almost a bad thing, you know? Like, it's not like a safe space. It's like, I don't want to get sent to the counselor. Yeah. I think back then, I think it's still the same.
It's still the same. Honestly, students still feel the same way. They have difficulty sharing their feelings. And typically, there are two types. There are some that will just like word vomit. They'll just tell you everything about what's happening in their lives. And then there's the type that's super, super reserved. And some in between. I would say from my experience teaching, you know, kids of different races as well, that the cultural background definitely factors into it. Typically, Chinese kids are less, they're just less used to, they're not used to talking about it. They find it weird. They're like, teacher, why are you asking me this? Like Celine said, like, you might not have feelings because having feelings is weird. They'll be like, I'm happy, lo. I'm like, are you sure you're happy? You know, this happened. And they're like, happy lah, I'm happy. Why are you asking me? You know, they get kind of defensive as well sometimes. Some have said that people don't ask questions like this. It's really weird. Like what Laura said, some might be like, what are you going to do with this information? They don't want to get sent to the counselor for sure, because it is sometimes used as a disciplinary measure, right? Something happens, then you get sent to the counselor. If you don't want to kena rotan, then you get sent to the counselor. And my counselor has spoken about this before. She said like that's something that a teacher can do that a counselor cannot do, is be in the classroom and build relationships with students. Because you are not suddenly going to go to the counselor and trust her immediately just because she has like the credentials for it. That it doesn't work that way for kids. So typically, when something happens in the classroom, when I see an issue, I try to deal with it first. And that is very taxing on me, but I know that my students trust me more. So it's about me talking to them first, seeing what happens, what do they need? Is it something that I can address myself? And if it isn't, if it's very serious, then I would talk to them about the possibility of seeing the counselor. But I wouldn't like say, oh, okay, I'm going to write you a memo and you're going to go see the counselor right away. But I would just ask them to consider it and then follow up until they agree to it. Yeah.
I'm cycling back to your earlier comment about your students not being able to express themselves. And I'm just thinking, you are teaching in a community that has faced significant trauma. They had the whole Sungai Kimkim pollution crisis last year. Not a lot of people were hospitalized. I'm sure it impacted everyone. And now you have the pandemic and you have MCO. Two very traumatic events, very close to each other. How are these kids processing it? Even though you say it's like, a teacher, I'm happy, like that, but is it also like a coping mechanism on top of all the family issues, the socioeconomic issues? What is going through these kids' heads?
I would think that they are suppressing certain feelings. So like with some students who are more upfront, like who share their feelings, they do share that they are feeling even more anxious than before. They might be feeling depressed. And with students who don't or who are not used to sharing their feelings, when I talk to them about it, it's become kind of like, oh, it's like that long. Because it's just another thing that has happened in their lives, which nobody has helped them to process, right? So nobody has sat down with them and told them, oh, this is happening. And like, oh, how does that make you feel? What's going to happen after this? Do you have any worries? That's never happened. It's kind of been like what happened in the news. Teacher is saying this. Okay, I just go home. Yeah, I just stay home. I do my thing. And the day after that, tomorrow and the day after that, it's all going to be the same for me. Yeah.
I'm curious about the role that the two counselors played in your school, Jingyi, when I would say all this trauma happened and it's still within their memory. What were the roles that these two counselors played?
So there is a response to it. Like they did have sessions with the students who were affected by Kimkim. So the students who had physical reactions, those that fainted and got sent to the emergency response center. Yeah, and the students who were close to those students. So there is a response. They do spend time to talk to the student and follow up on the students after. With the pandemic, the Ministry of Education did have a nationwide survey that tested on anxiety and stress post-COVID for the students. So then the counselor's role after that is to do intervention, so to see these students again and to just help them through their problems. Maybe Gladys can add more on this. Yeah.
I was going on to Gladys and wanting to ask her, you know, because you are a counselor for your school, whether are you guys trained for this, or do you have the support system behind you or resources behind you to support the work that you need to do in these schools, Gladys?
I feel like my answer is always, I'm never trained enough, because I feel like the cases you see are always so different. And I feel like there's just so many new things coming up and you just never know what's going to happen. And even if there wasn't any COVID, like every student's situation is different. And yes, there are some principles that you can always fall back on, but still, I feel like you could never stop learning how to be a better counselor, better at talking to students and relating with them. I think there has been actually, thankfully, there have been quite some good resources. Like since I started working, I've worked for 4 years now in my job, and across these 4 years, there have been opportunities for like to attend conferences, trainings. Like, even this year, we had the Befrienders, they organized the suicide prevention thing. It was like 1 day thing. And prior to this year, we always had the Strong Mental Health Conference and even like some of the overseas ones. Yeah, so I think there have been good opportunities where, you know, if you know them, you should go. And you like, usually it's funny because when we go to these conferences, you see the same faces because the same bunch of counselors, and we're like, yeah, we need help, you know? And we're like, and then sometimes some of our like tea break is like sitting and like, hey, so you know, what's your case? It's actually cases. And we're like, yeah, we don't really know what to do. Well, what do you think? Huh? You know, kind of thing. And sometimes it's like all these questions, but sometimes it's just like sharing, you know, our like just common feelings and experiences. And I think those conversations are just as good as actually attending those talks. So I think there is thankfully support from, you know, your own community, but you just have to get plugged in. And I think you need to be initiative to look for some of these resources so that at least you don't feel alone, because in our counseling, a lot of things are PNC and we can't always share it with other teachers. So I think that it's really important to stay connected.
Well, I'm glad that both of you as teachers are finding, you know, really creative and awesome ways to at least create safe environments for the students to share about how they feel during this period. I guess I have to emphasize that point again, that a lot of people need to see teachers as human beings too, that they do go through their own emotional struggles, their own emotional stress, just trying to cope with the situation, trying to cope with the students that they've built a relationship with, and knowing all these things are coming through. So Jingyi, you brought up something about the KKM sending out survey forms. So Gladys, I'm just going to ask you too, you know, what about your school as a counselor? Were you also part of this survey, or did you have to facilitate this survey?
Yeah, they sent it out, and it's like what Jingyi said, it's a bunch of pre-screenings. There's a screening for anxiety and another for depression, and they even have a checklist of student needs, and it includes things like just checking if they've lost any loved one during this pandemic, if they've seen their parents go out of jobs, have they thought of self-harming, do they feel like they get enough support from teachers, are they worried about their education? So I think these questions are pretty good, they're pretty real, and I think the tools are there, it's just, and so we have to carry it out. I think the taxing thing about it is that having one person to just execute it for the whole school is virtually quite impossible given the time frame. I started it like last month or last 1-2 months, and I've only gotten through two years, you know. I started with the older kids and then now going to like the form fours, and now we're on e-learning again. So like I was supposed to meet a couple of students this week in person to go through, you know, talk to them. And, you know, it's hard enough to get students to counseling because they always feel like they've done something wrong, you know. So you try your best to make it sound like, hey, you know, I just wanted to have a chat, you know, about this survey you just recently did so that I can serve you better. And it's always so much better to do that in person. So now I'm like trying to think, I'm like sending this email and say, hey, you know, are you free for a chat? And most students will tell you like they get a bit antsy when it comes to video calls. Somehow they just don't, I don't know, they just don't like video calls. Like this girl, she's even resorting. She's like, oh, I don't mind email. I'm like, oh, okay, sure, you know, whatever works for you. Yeah, I think that's taxing because I think when you do interventions, you don't just want to do it once. You don't just meet them once, but you do follow-ups. You could be attending to a student for like a month, if or more. I don't know how I'm going to get through all the students in my school to get through these screenings. Because I don't want to do a screening and then like when I know their scores, then I'm troubled by that, you know, then I don't see them. So I do it like, batch by batch. Will I finish it by next year, maybe?
What about you, Jingyi? I mean, have you got any idea how that survey went about in your school?
So they completed the survey specifically on Form 5 students first. So similar to what Gladys did, they started with upper form and then they wanted to go through, like follow up with the students who showed certain symptoms first. But then even with the school reopening, like the counselors have more jobs to do rather than just counseling itself, right? So there's so many things, like even student attendance is under the portfolio of counselors. So they haven't been able to do that. And what happened was last month, I got the opportunity to invite a NGO to maybe collaborate with us to do intervention in our schools. So over the past month, we've been trying to work out the details, and then schools closed. So that's what happened. Yeah, it's supposed to be a 8-week program that uses a form of therapy that kind of just teaches students how to cope better and to address their whatever emotional distress they have. But yeah, with the constraints now, I don't think that it's going to happen. Before the program started, we had just screened the Form 3 and Form 4 students, and the results were quite alarming. Yeah, a lot of students need help, but we are not going to be able to do that.
Wow, I mean, it's amazing, because even back when I was in high school, and that was what, 3 decades ago, going to see the counselor was like a death sentence of sorts, you know, like that's going to hang over you for the rest of your school life, you know, the fact that you went to see the counselor and all that. But now in our situation right now, the school really needs counselors, because the situation warrants it, and people are just looking for an avenue to kind of like release the stress that they are experiencing right now in this situation. So there's this huge need for counselors. And I like the fact that you're not only turning to the KKM or the Ministry of Health for help, or even the Ministry of Education, but you're also turning to NGOs, I believe, right? NGOs and other bodies. Is that easier to do, like to invite an NGO to your school to run these programs?
I think it's just that they have the resources. It's more flexible in that sense. At the same time, it's also become a thing where teachers have to take up the role of like certain counselors, so being able to teach students, like I said, how to manage their emotions kind of also helps to deal with the problem. So I have friends in Semporna. So Semporna has been on lockdown for an entire month or so, right? And they did realize when schools reopened, while schools were open, that students were suffering from like the aftermath of, you know, the stress of MCO and then schools shut down again. So what they've been doing is they ran an initiative called Olidas, and they've been doing these psychoeducation modules virtually for their students. So just kind of to teach them how to identify their emotions and then kind of to figure out an alternate future that they want to have and look for solutions themselves. So teaching that emotional resilience in the students.
This sounds really interesting, Jingyi, this Olidas psychoeducation program. Could you maybe tell us a bit about where we can find more information on this?
They are on Instagram. So it's a group of 7 teachers in Semporna that started the program only just, if I'm not mistaken, 2 or 3 weeks ago. So there's a series of 6 workshops that they've already run, and I think they still have a few modules to finish.
That's so cool. Teachers are coming up with their own creative ways to address this issue. Gladys, what about your school? I mean, have you guys run any intervention programs, or you know, programs to just help the students out?
We try. I think that's a key word, because this year we collaborated with UNIMAS to run this program called Super Skills for Life, and it was targeted for like primary level, which is great because we want to teach this since young, right? So it was about teaching, and we targeted like students who are at risk for like behavioral issues, emotional issues, and low self-esteem. So it's just a very small class, and it's they have a syllabus. It was developed, I think, by Professor Cecilia, who's currently a professor in Roehampton, UK. And she's actually Sri Lankan. She developed the whole module because she wanted to see mental health better in here. So we tried it for like a couple of weeks where if these kids, they'll learn to identify their emotions, their thoughts, how to manage it, how to grow healthy self-esteem, really good stuff. And we only managed to run for a couple of weeks. And then MCO happened. And so we'll be on a full stop. Since then, it's hard to consider when we can rerun it again. Hopefully next year.
Well, we can only hope and pray that things will turn a corner come next year. And we've got 2 more months till January. And that's the hope and the wish we have for the future. And looking ahead to the future, we can only hope and pray for what we wish we can do when that comes about, because there is a big need to help these students deal with the stress once they come out of it. And I think this is something that we need to start preparing from now.
So listening to Gladys, Jingyi, and Celine talk about your students, the situation in your schools, I have the same thought in my head that I have repeated in previous episodes, that COVID itself did not create a mental health crisis. It simply revealed an underlying mental health crisis. And the thing is, perhaps it is a blessing in disguise, because we are forced, policymakers, administrators, educators, we are forced to admit that there's a problem. We are forced to deal with it now because so many students are suffering. You know, so many students are going through things even if they don't know how to express it. And we have this national survey, National Health and Mobility Survey. There's an adolescence version. It was last done in 2017. And prior to that, it was 2012. In that 5-year period, they could actually see that mental health issues had increased by so much in adolescence. This is like 13 to 17 year olds. It's included things like addiction, alcohol use, suicidal ideation, suicidal attempts. It rose by as much as 3%. So we do have a problem. It's not something that's, it's not really happening, that kind of thing anymore. It is happening. And COVID has simply torn away that veil. So looking at this year's World Mental Health Day theme, it's mental health for all, greater investment, greater access. And this is so important because the world is realizing that we are at the brink of another pandemic, a mental health pandemic. What can we do now? And what is your hope? What kind of investments do you want to see happen in our schools, given that we already have initiatives going on? You know, KKM did a survey. We have really good counselors in place. Just that they are really overwhelmed with the amount of work. And we have NGOs and teachers coming up with their own really interesting initiatives to help their students. But what do you guys think?
I think there's so many that you don't know where to start. Systemically, I think there has to be just so much more emphasis on emotional well-being. I think where we have progressed as a country more in awareness on mental health, but we're still quite far behind. There's still a lot of stigma and a lot of incorrect perception that makes it hard for people to be vulnerable and to admit where they're really at. So I don't really know what it takes for the system to change, because I think it's also embedded together with cultural context and, you know, the different things that we even talk about, what Chinese have a harder time expressing, right? So it goes just beyond like addressing the current generation, because it affects like parents as well and their perception of mental health. So I don't know about systemically, like it feels like so overwhelming to address. On another note, I feel like it would really help if we had so many more first responders. Like, and I think first responders is not just people who are trained, but first responders, actually it was, I had this term because I was inspired by what Jingyi said. She was saying about like teachers have to be, they know the students better. And it's so true, like a lot of the students I counsel, I had to spend time, the extra time to get to know them first. But why can't the teacher who already knows them, already interacts with them on a daily basis or something like that, why can't they, you know, be the first responders? Like we should empower or like train teachers how to learn to relate to students, how to be more sensitive, like don't call them out, you know, like if they're going to a counseling room and they're not as sensitive, don't announce to the whole class, you know? So simple things like that. And how can they create safe spaces for them? How can they create time to talk about these things as they're teaching, or how to be just more like friends and don't belittle their things just because they're so much older and they've seen much more things in life. You know, things, I think little things like that, first responders, and then even parents, I think, should be first responders too. Like, don't leave the job just to teachers to parent your kids in school, because they spend half of their day at home. I think, again, I've received so many like parents who think that their kids, what they're going through is nothing compared to the real world, which again, logically, yes, but that's not what your kid needs to hear right now. And right now, they just need your support, they need your understanding, and they need, like, you know, that just sometimes that assurance that you're just there with them and you're not belittling what they're going through right now. So I think like there could be so much more we could do just on like, you know, the like grassroots level and like the first responders, how we can help kids to go through what they're going through. Sorry, that was a lot.
But that's so true, you know, and that's really fundamental. You know, we need to address it on a fundamental level. What about you, Jingyi?
Like what Gladys said, there needs to be systemic change. It doesn't just come down to surveys and what can we do as intervention, because the system itself reinforces that emotional well-being isn't important. Like we are prioritizing, for example, performance. We are prioritizing like if we talk about teachers being first responders and teachers like addressing these needs, then are teachers supported to do that? Like on top of their regular workload, like what is being prioritized really? Is it about getting the work done, getting the paperwork done, or are we thinking about the students? And then with parents, they do need to be present in their children's lives. But I also think about how it's not possible for some parents to do that. And that is another systemic issue. Yeah. If you do not have the means to take care of your family, like you don't work a job that's a living wage, then you are not able to take out the time to spend with your kids, to even talk to them every day. When I think about all that, like the change that needs to happen really, like it has to be both bottom up and top down. Like there are many decisions that we cannot make as educators, that parents cannot just make that change just because they want to. So raising awareness is definitely where it starts, but it has to be more than what are we doing, like slapping on a band-aid for just trying to aid our students as they are experiencing trauma. It's definitely important for that to be done, but at the same time, we have to look at the bigger picture.
Wow. I mean, that's so true. And it cuts across what I believe is the fundamental point. We need to create awareness. We need to start with really with the people who are closest to our young people, the teachers, their parents, their family unit, and so on and so forth. And wow. Yes, Laura.
I just had this random thought listening to both Gladys and Jingyi, that maybe we need to rebrand mental health. Maybe we need to rebrand mental health to make it more than just a vocabulary of feelings and emotions. Because like both of you just said, it's systemic. Mental health issues do not exist in isolation. They're interconnected with so many things, like the education system that's focused on performance, lack of job opportunities for students who are not academically inclined, family issues, and disasters like COVID, which are totally out of our control. What if we rebrand mental health such that we are teaching children from a very young age how to adult? So you have adulting classes, which encompasses learning how to manage your emotions, learning how to manage anger without throwing a huge tantrum, or being aggressive towards the people around you, how to deal with being with failure and disappointment and not give up on things, how to be more resilient. And all of these coping skills are building blocks to becoming a more mature, a more functional, well-rounded adult who will be able to cope with life, no matter what life throws at him or her. So let's maybe talk about this another episode. How do we rebrand mental health so that people don't get so iffy about emotions, feelings, all this touchy-feely stuff?
Yeah, I definitely do feel like if I had the vocabulary, and not just the vocabulary, but like how to identify the symptoms, what is what and why am I feeling this way earlier on, it would make so much more sense to me rather than, you know, having to figure it out as I grow older. And oh my god, I lost my train of thought. Like figuring out as I grow older, like just through, you know, word of mouth, like talking to you, to peers, and like just stumbling upon it, like it would make it so much easier if I were taught that vocabulary. And yeah,
which is something that I think merits its own podcast series, a whole episode on, you know, adulting, you know, becoming an adult and what mental health initiatives or programs we could have had when we were in school, and that would have really impacted us as we move on into adulthood. So folks, thank you very much for tonight. I think everything said was golden, was awesome. You know, it's great to hear from both Jingyi and Gladys, educators who are coping with what is going on in our country, Malaysia, and also the whole world. Thank you, Celine, for coming in. You know, it's great to have the youngest person in the group telling us that our mental health really needs to begin early, because even as you are in uni, you're facing these issues. And it's great to have all of you here. And folks, once again, this is Mind Brew Chat, and this is a special edition where we are having conversations with educators. And this is part of our program for the World Mental Health Day 2020, where the theme was Mental Health for All, Greater Access and Greater Investment. Do check us up on the podcast. We are on Spotify. So do follow us, and we will let you know when the next episodes are coming out. So with that, this is MacLean. I'm signing off, and I'll see you guys again in the next episode of Mind Brew Chats. See you guys. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Mind Brew Chats. Find out more about Mind Brew on our social media platforms at Mind Brew KCH. That's Mind Brew KCH on Instagram and Facebook. Don't forget to like and subscribe for future updates.